I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, President Obama in Arizona has just unveiled a $75 billion plan that he says will keep 9 million Americans from losing their homes. The plan is aimed at two groups of people: homeowners who are underwater, their homes are worth less than they owe, and people who can't afford their mortgages, they're facing imminent foreclosure.
The plan I'm announcing focuses on rescuing families who played by the rules and acted responsibly by refinancing loans for millions of families in traditional mortgages who are underwater or close to it, by modifying loans for families stuck in subprime mortgages they can't afford as a result of skyrocketing interest rates or personal misfortune, and by taking broader steps to keep mortgage rates low so that families can secure loans with affordable monthly payments.
Let's get David Leonhardt to start us off. He's economics and business columnist for The New York Times. And David, you were writing today that the big question, or one of the big questions, was whether or not President Obama would include people in underwater loans in his rescue plan. These are people who can afford their mortgages, but, you know, are looking at their home values dropping. Well, it seems as if he has included them.
He has, although not to the extent that some of the rhetoric he used suggests. And so the politics of this are tricky because, as with the Wall Street bailout, we need to end up helping some people who made bad decisions, right? That we want to do it to some extent for humanitarian reasons, but mainly for economic reasons.
Yeah, we don't want the whole country to have their home values plummet.
That's right. But it's much easier to sell this if you say what we're doing is we're rescuing people who've played by the rules, to use the president's phrase. And so he talked a lot in the speech about people who'd done absolutely nothing wrong and for reasons beyond their control find themselves in trouble. And there are a group of people in that situation. Their house has fallen in value and they're unable to refinance because of this decline in value. And the plan's going to do some things to help those people. But nationwide, we've got already something like $500 billion in mortgage debt that's now underwater. And by underwater, I mean the value of the mortgage is worth more than the value of the house. And so we already have a $500 billion difference nationwide. That's probably going to end up close to $1 trillion. The kinds of refinancing options and refinancing help he was announcing today will make a difference for some underwater people, but they're not going to make any kind of major dent in that $500,000 gap. And so economically, if you kind of dig into the numbers, the real crux of what he's doing in this is trying to help people who cannot afford their monthly payments.
And these are the subprime loans?
Not all subprime loans. It's a combination. It's a combination of people who made decisions that I think, in retrospect, we can clearly say were bad decisions. And then it's other people who made decisions that, in retrospect, we would probably say this is really not their fault.
All sorts of people. I just want to say the president addressed people who've lost their jobs and suddenly, you know, can't pay their mortgage. I mean, all sorts of people in the mix. So continue.
Well, so it's interesting. I mean, he said, you know, this plan is not going to help people who bought more house than they can afford at one point.
Well, you know, I want to stop you there, David, because that's one of our biggest questions. How do you figure out who those people are?
You look at the ratio of their monthly mortgage payments to their income. And a lot of people ended up often with these adjustable rate mortgages, took out mortgages that they really had no hope of ever repaying. And maybe they were duped into doing it by the bank. I think in some cases that clearly happened. Maybe they figured irrationally that their income would go up a lot in future years. I think that happened in some cases. Maybe they realized what was going on and thought, you know what, I'm never going to be able to afford that mortgage when the interest rate adjusts in 5 years. But it doesn't matter because house prices are going up so fast that I'll simply refinance or I'll simply sell
and flip it
to someone else and I'll get out from under it. But obviously house prices stop going up.
So that's going to eliminate a lot of people. If those kinds of people who speculated, people who should have known better, that's going to take a lot of people out of the equation, isn't it?
Well, it would, but he's not eliminating those people. Those people will still get help in this. So the key here, they don't try to divine people's motivations. What they instead do is they look at this ratio of their mortgage payments and their overall debt to their income. And so you're going to have some people who, if you bought massively more home than you could afford, they're not going to help you. And he made that very clear in the speech. If you bought a little bit more home than you could afford, and by having the bank lower your monthly payment a little bit and having the government subsidize that reduction, you could stay in your home, they're going to help you. And they're going to help you whether or not you find yourself in that situation because you had your hours reduced at work or because you simply bought too much house. And so I love this word speculators, right? Because we kind of separate people into the bad speculators who are gambling on the real estate market, and we're not going to help them. And he said that, something very close to that in the speech. He used the word speculators. And then the good people who did absolutely nothing wrong and instead find themselves in a bad circumstance, we're going to help those people. And the fact is it's just not so black and white. We are going to, in fact, help some people who made bad decisions. And I'm actually deeply uncomfortable with that. I don't feel like we owe it to people who gambled on a house and bought a lot more house than they can afford. I don't think we owe it to them to bail them out. I don't view that as some wonderful Main Street bailout.
Well, David,
I view it as unfortunately necessary given the situation.
I'm glad to let you finish that, because you do think it's necessary to get those bad assets, off the books so that we can get credit flowing again. David Leonhardt from the New York Times. Hold on there one second, because I want to bring Bruce Marks in, housing activist, founder and CEO of NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. He's been quite vocal, in fact, leading protests in front of the homes of CEOs of banks to try to get them to negotiate with homeowners who are heading for foreclosure. And Bruce, you've been very vocal that you wanted an aspect of the plan to ensure that banks would allow homeowners to refinance and not spend more than 31% of their income on their monthly mortgage. What did you hear from the president?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do, Robin, is let's take a walk down memory lane. If we take this walk down memory lane, we remember a time when we had a fixed mortgage that was based on what the homeowner can afford. We used to have what was called in this country a variable rate mortgage. And that variable rate mortgage went up and it went down depending on the market. And we used to have a time when we had a community banker. And we went to that community banker and we said, I want a mortgage for $300,000. And that community banker said, no, Bruce, you can only afford a mortgage for $200,000. And now what do we have today? Today we don't have fixed rate mortgages based on what the homeowner can afford. We don't have variable rate mortgages that go up or down. They always go up.
But the president is calling for reform. That was one of the points. And he is calling for refinancing.
But the refinancing he's calling for are only the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac mortgages. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are the least problematic. And he's incorporated subprime practices by saying, yes, I'll give you an affordable mortgage payment for 5 years, but by definition, it's going to go up $200, $300, $400 after 5 years. So the fact of the matter is we've got to go back to the past that says a fixed rate based on what the homeowner can afford, a variable rate that goes up or down, and stop these kind of mortgages that have an initial affordable period, which is what he's proposing, that by definition are going to go up in 5 years.
Which, as you say, it's just like a subprime and these variable interest rates that just shot up and was often in the small print and people didn't see it coming. Well, hold on, Bruce Marks, because Mark Charney is here. He's a real estate broker from Wellesley, Massachusetts. It's a suburb of Boston where we are. He's the guy who's hired by banks to deal with foreclosed properties. You've been in them. You've met people who try to take a stand and not leave. Mark, what did you think the real estate industry and banks heard today?
Well, I think they heard an attempt by the Barack Obama administration to do something about this problem concretely. Unfortunately, the backlog of properties that are not going to be fixed by this program or any other program are all in limbo right now. And this time that things are in limbo is creating further problems for the overall value of the market.
Well, do you think that banks heard the incentive to renegotiate with people? I mean, the president talked about subsidies from the government to fill the gap. If a bank agrees to lower a mortgage rate but loses money in so doing, the government will help fill that gap. Will that help?
I think so. I mean, I think they saw parts of the plan that will help. But The banks know their portfolios. They know which loans can be helped and they know which loans can't be helped. And unfortunately, this is such a political hot button where, you know, we want to help the people that are going to be pushed out of their house, no doubt. But there's so many of these loans that aren't going to be fixed through modification.
Because people won't be able to handle them in some cases anyway.
Absolutely.
David Leonhardt, you still there? David Leonhardt of The Times, you still there? Oh, we've lost him. Well, Bruce Marks, oh, is he there?
I am here.
Hi, David.
Hi.
I just want your thoughts on that. You know, some people think that this is, you just heard Bruce Marks say, it's sort of, you know, using the same kind of subprime thinking, give him a break for a few years, but then hit him again with higher rates. And as Mark Charney just said, he sees people that even if they get a break, aren't going to be able to afford, you know, millions of homes, they're not going to be able to afford it. Your thoughts on that? Is this in some ways kicking this down the road?
No, I don't think it is. I think that, look, we can't solve the foreclosure problem. It's way too late for that. There are too many people, as Mark was saying, who are in homes that they simply cannot afford. And to bail them all out would be massively expensive. But we can make a difference at this point. There are enough people who are close enough that we can give the banks some government subsidies, in effect. We can knock some heads with the banks because banks aren't always that good at reworking these mortgages, even when it's in their long-term interest, because the costs of foreclosure are so high for banks as well. And so we can make some difference here on the margin.
And Brad, I just have to interrupt for 1 second because Bruce Marks, did I just hear you groan?
Yes, please.
Go ahead.
No, David, you can't give up the boat on this. It's dead wrong. I have legally binding agreements, NACA has, for over 90% of the homeowners at risk of foreclosure that with all the services that cover 90% of the homeowners. These servicers have to restructure the mortgage based on what the homeowner can afford by reducing permanently for the life of the loan to 3% and, if necessary, reduce the outstanding principal.
So, Bruce, we just have
$1 taxpayer money.
We just have about a minute left. Bruce is saying, David, that he has been able to do that. He's been able to negotiate very firmly with banks and get them to renegotiate to affordable loans.
I mean, I'm sure that in some cases that works, but this isn't simply a matter of, oh, if only everyone sits around at a table, there's a solution that is free. There isn't. A lot of people bought homes that they can't afford. A lot of banks gave mortgages that are never
you
going to be paid off.
David,
so this isn't simply a matter of asking people to think straight and suddenly it will all be solved.
Well, you know what? This is an impassioned issue. Bruce Marks, frequent guest on Here and Now, we'll have you back. And David, we always appreciate your insight. Mark Charney, as well, a real estate agent who has gone into some of these foreclosed homes and knows how hard it is inside some of these homes. We thank you all for weighing in. Just some real, you know, quick, instant analysis of what we just heard, but we promise you we'll be mulling it over for days to come, and hopefully with all of you great guests. But just ahead, why we're spending so much time on this topic, why it's so tough. One Florida county has instituted a rocket docket. They speed foreclosure cases through court, 800 a day. It's sort of like speed dating for foreclosures. Where do you hear? In 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back. And we've been talking about the plan to stem the housing crisis that President Obama unveiled just today. And a story in today's Wall Street Journal caught our eye about what's being called the rocket docket. Now, this gives you an idea of how bad the situation is in some parts of the country. The rocket docket speeds nearly 1,000 foreclosure cases every day through one court in Lee County, Florida, one of the areas worst hit by the housing crisis. Charlie Green is clerk of circuit courts in Lee County, Florida. He set up the rocket docket. Charlie, first of all, explain why you needed this sort of speed dating system. What was the problem?
Well, last year in February, March, and April, I noticed a tremendous backlog of cases that needed to be heard. Let me give you January 06. Mm-hmm. For that month, we had 92 foreclosures filed. And then in January of 07, we had 481 filed.
Whoa.
And then in January of 08, we had 2,293.
Boy, fourfold.
That's correct. In fact, since January 1 of 06, we've had 45,791 foreclosures filed.
So you have almost, you know, you have 800 cases a day.
Right.
And so how, what's the process? How do they go before the judge? Give us a typical exchange.
Case number 07-000-CA-192. Is there anyone here who, you know, protests this procedure? No. Boom.
Done.
That's done.
And what if there is somebody who's got all their papers, they've, you know, somebody, you know, whose mortgage it is that's in foreclosure, and they're standing there and they're called up before the judge? What might that exchange be like?
Well, the judge would ask them if they've made any payments, if they're in default. And if they're in default under Florida law, that's pretty much it. And then the judge might say, are you still living in the house? And if they say yes, then what our judge will say is, typically, you have 45 to 60 days more to stay in your house. And then they have to get out.
So how long might that entire exchange take?
That particular exchange may take 4 or 5 seconds, maybe 10.
Whoa. And how many?
It could be a little longer.
And how many of those might you get in a day?
Say we have 1,000 in the docket scheduled to be heard. Of those, we'll hear 800 to 850 because for whatever reason the other 100 or so don't go. Mm-hmm. There'll probably be maybe 35 to 40 right. at the most. It's only about 13 to 15% have somebody in the house.
Right. So the two questions are asked, is that considered, you know, being lenient to give the people 45, sometimes 60 days more to stay in the house?
I think it is. And I think it is for this reason. These people have been in foreclosure for a long time. They have made no payments. Taxes have not been paid on this property for a long time. So these people have known this was coming. This is not a surprise. This doesn't just pop out of the box and say, "Woo, I'm being foreclosed." They know it's coming. Now, it doesn't make it any less painful for them, and it certainly doesn't make it less painful for the judge. But you have to administer to the law. That's what the judge is doing. These people have to assume some responsibility, and they're given an extra 45 days or 60 days to stay in the house, and then they've got to leave.
Well, and tell us who some of these people are, because there's a mixed bag in Florida. There were, you know, people who were tricked into mortgages that had interest rates that rose, but also people who thought,
let us just say that when the real estate market was in a frenzy, people were borrowing money they should have never borrowed. Mm-hmm. One of my friends described it this way. A candy store is built in a high foot traffic area, and it's a first-class candy store. It has confections that are unbelievably delicious. And on the front of the store is a sign that says, come in, you don't have to buy. And throughout the candy store are free samples. And people eat these little samples, and they're delicious. And then they go to the back of the store looking for more free samples. And there in the back it says, you can buy these with no money down. And these wonderfully tasty confections are yours, and you can pay us later. And that's what happened. People bought properties and borrowed money they should never have borrowed. They were blinded by the beauty of it all. And then we had people saying, you can flip this property before you ever make a mortgage payment.
We understand there's something in your area called the Millionaire University. It's not a real university, but it's a program that taught speculators how to buy and sell. If one of those speculators were to come before the Rocket Docket and answer those two questions and say, I don't live there and I'm not keeping up.
Maybe 30 at the most.
The judge would be less sympathetic.
Of course. Remember, we have very few people that actually come to the Rocket Docket.
Yeah.
Most of the people walked. They just walked away from their loss. You know, these people with families, you know, if you don't have some compassion for people with families and children and all that, then shame on you. You know, and our judges do. But at the same time, everybody has to try to do the right thing.
Well, let me ask you, Charlie Green, about some of the things we're hearing about the Obama rescue plan for homeowners. For instance, the idea of subsidizing banks and sort of leaning on banks to restructure loans. Is that going to help in Florida, a state where there's so much unemployment?
It could help. But I think what needs to happen from my perspective is lending needs to take on a responsible role. People need to be structured so that when they buy a house or they buy a property, they've got an investment so that they can't walk away. If you had nothing down, it's pretty easy to walk away. You've ruined your credit, but a lot of those people don't care.
Well, and are you also saying that maybe they shouldn't be able to get mortgages that are bigger than a certain percentage of their income?
Well, of course. We had absolutely no controls on lending down here or anywhere else in this country for probably 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And it's been a very, you know, we had a feeding frenzy of real estate activity. It was just unbelievable. And now we're reaping that. But there is some good news. The good news is that we're hitting bottom, we're ricocheting on the bottom, and values are there for people to pick up new properties or slightly used properties, whatever, and start over again. So you can buy a house again. You know, the house that was worth $110,000 5 years ago and went up to $280,000 or $300,000 is now worth $110,000 again.
Right. Charlie Green, thanks very much.
Yes, ma'am.
Charlie Green, clerk of circuit courts in Lee County, Florida. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, President Obama may soon switch his attention from housing to stem cell research. Will he overturn the Bush-era restrictions? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, from eyes to unmentionables, body parts, one scientist says, argue against intelligent design. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A leading group of zoologists is threatening to boycott Louisiana because they say that state is inching towards allowing creationism to be taught in schools. As you know, this is a heated debate, and our next guest wants to weigh in on creationism and its cousin, intelligent design, the thinking that the human body is pretty neat, so neat that only an intelligent being like God could have designed it. The body's too complex to be the result of a series of random mutations, as in Darwin's theory of evolution. Well, Abby Hafer is professor of anatomy and physiology at Curry College. She says that what she sees isn't intelligent, but a jerry-rigged system of flaws. She joins us. And Abby, you talk about unintelligent design. You focus on five body parts. Now, this might be tender for some people, but let's start with your favorite.
Okay. My favorite argument for unintelligent design in the human body is the male testicle. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about this argument is as soon as I start talking about testicles, people pay attention. So the testicles hang outside the body in a sac of skin called the scrotum, because human body temperature is too hot for sperm production. A vulnerable organ is put in a vulnerable place, and putting a valuable and vulnerable organ in such a vulnerable location is bad design.
Well, you point out that frogs, for instance, keep their vulnerable organs inside their bodies, so there was somewhere, you know, a choice.
Well, you'd think that an intelligent designer would make normal body temperature and sperm production compatible. And that's not what we're seeing with human beings.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another one of your examples. Now that we have everyone's attention, what about the eye?
The eye is badly designed because the light-sensitive part of our eye, which is called the retina, is actually buried behind some blood vessels and nerve fibers, so that light, in trying to get to the photoreceptors, has to work its way past and be blocked by these various fibers.
And does this lead to the blind spot that we have in our eyes?
Yes, and that is because all of the nerve fibers that are on top of our retina converge and go right through the retina and into the optic nerve. So there's this one area that is so clogged with all of this paraphernalia that it can't see at all.
Well, and you've got a way that people can find their blind spot if they don't really believe there is one. We're going to put it at our website later today. But it's fascinating. I've got a piece of paper here with an X and an O. And if I look at the paper and move it in towards my eye at a certain point, there it is, right there, the O disappears. Now, I know what's on the paper, but it disappears just at that one point, not before it and not after it. I've got a blind spot.
And putting preventable blind spots into a visual system is not the sign of an infallible creator.
Okay, well, this is a fascinating exercise here. And again, we'll have it on our website. It's a lot of fun. But I know you've heard the arguments against your thinking, and let's stay with the eye. Michael Behe, a biochemist at Lehigh University, says that the eye, for instance, is irreducibly complex. In other words, if any part of it is missing, it won't function. And so that, to him, is proof that there is not evolution, because if you have an irreducibly complex system, it can't be produced through natural selection or evolution. It is irreducibly complex. It is what it is.
Well, the great thing about the human eye is that although it is wonderfully complex, it is very reducible. You can see eyes that are just a couple of light-sensitive cells, and that's all they are. It's still an eye.
And, of course, he would say that even that two-cell system is irreducibly complex. If you took anything out of it, it wouldn't be what it is.
Well, you can also see eyes that belong to single-celled organisms. All they are is a batch of photopigment, a little bit of light-sensitive chemical. It responds to light, and that allows the one-celled organism to orient its chloroplasts towards the sun so that it can photosynthesize. That's a pretty well-reduced eye.
Okay, well, let's stay with the parts of your body that you hold up as being so imperfect that certainly if somebody had a choice in the matter, they would have done a better job. The birth canal.
The birth canal. It's a basic engineering problem. On the one hand, we walk on two legs. That favors narrow hips because that makes walking easier and more efficient. On the other hand, we're very smart. Being very smart requires large heads, and large heads require wide hips for a wide birth canal. And the result is something that frankly doesn't work very well, which is why lots of women used to die in childbirth and why we now have lots of cesarean sections. If this had been designed, they would have made us into something like a kangaroo. Kangaroos give birth to these tiny, embryo-like young, which then complete their development in a pouch outside the body. It has a nipple for nursing, and that is where they turn into baby kangaroos. And that's the way to do it if you're going to be a biped.
I didn't know that kangaroos had a nipple for nursing in their pouch.
Oh, they do.
Fascinating. What about the throat? Why is that imperfect in your mind?
We have a common entrance for air and food, the mouth, and we can choke to death because we have these two tubes with a common entrance. And I say that a wise creator would have given us two separate tubes with two separate entrances.
Or a blowhole.
Well,
like
that's
whales.
What whales got. Whales got two tubes with two separate entrances. You have the blowhole, which leads directly to its respiratory system, and you have the mouth, which goes to its digestive system. So whales can't inhale their food and choke on it.
Let's get just your one last example in the appendix. A sac that hangs off our large intestines. A problem because?
Because it's a really great place for a bacterial colony. And every now and then it gets infected, and if the infected appendix is not removed surgically, then we'll die.
Does it have any use?
Not really. It doesn't really do anything particularly useful or special.
Well, I know you shared your thoughts about unintelligent design with your minister. What was his response?
Well, there was one time when I knew my minister was going to be giving a sermon on Darwin, and just beforehand, I had this inspiration about testicles.
Okay.
And so I wrote to him about it.
And if you just dropped in on our conversation, I should say that your inspiration about testicles is that they are vulnerable, they're outside of the body, they're an imperfect design. Yes, go on. So what did your minister say?
He repeated my argument to the entire congregation from the pulpit that Sunday. And people certainly did remember it.
By the way, I'm just curious, how does your minister reconcile, you know, a belief in Darwin and a belief in God?
Well, basically, lots of people believe that you shouldn't check your brain at the door of the church and that it's far from unholy to apply rational thought to your beliefs. I can't really comment on how my minister looks at God. What I can tell you is that many, many people believe that revelation is not sealed. So the wonders of the universe are still unfolding around us. And I think that if you close your eyes to evolution, then you're missing out on the greatest indisputably true story ever told.
Abby Hafer, professor of anatomy and physiology at Curry College. What a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me in.
Okay, and those of you made uncomfortable by the discussion of those body parts, you can come out now. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, if you turned on your TV this morning and nothing happened, don't fiddle with the antenna, which you probably have, because you're probably one of millions of Americans who's not yet ready for the digital switch. As of midnight last night, about a third of U.S. TV stations turned off their analog signals and began broadcasting in digital only. The rest of the stations will make the switch in June. Most people won't need to do anything, and many have already taken some steps, but roughly 6 million American households still need to upgrade their technology in order to watch TV. And a lot of people have questions. Mark Lloyd is Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. So, Mark, first of all, tell us, why is a civil rights group involved in this issue?
Well, we very strongly believe that all Americans have a right to access free over-the-air television, and that it's important mainly for emergency broadcast purposes to understand that there's a weather emergency, that there's a tornado coming, that there's, heaven forbid, some sort of terrorist attack and they need to prepare for something.
Huh. So a far more serious issue to you than, you know, whether you can watch The Office or something like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's a costly switch for people to make. Either they had to buy a new TV or pay, you know, maybe $100 a month for cable or satellite, or buy a digital converter box, you know, from $40 up. Now, the government offered coupons. The coupons ran out. There was so much demand, and the switchover was delayed. But now, first of all, we understand more government coupons are going to be available?
That's right. And the government has been sending out hundreds of thousands of coupons on a monthly basis, even after the coupon program officially ran out of funds roughly at the end of last year. With the new stimulus package that was passed and signed by the president, more money is going to go into their pot. And so this long waiting list of now over 2 million folks will be able to get their coupons.
Yeah. Okay, so hopefully you won't have to wait more than 4 to 6 weeks, we understand?
That's okay. The hope.
And the switchover for the bulk, the two-thirds of the TV stations who haven't switched over, is in June. But as we said, over 400 stations already made the switch last night. The FCC gave them permission after ascertaining that there would be some other television station in their area that didn't switch, so people would still have service. But we understand that even when this new deadline passes in June, not all stations are going to be digital?
That's right. So we have a number of low-power television stations, community broadcast television stations. Some of them translate network affiliate programs from ABC or CBS. And some of them provide very distinct and important community programming, sometimes in languages other than English. And so many of these stations will not be necessarily making the switch to digital in June.
Now, your group has set up help centers in some major markets where people can call or go for help. By the way, what are you hearing today from them?
Well, we are in 7 cities. A number of the cities that we're in have that mix of digital and analog. And so we're hearing some confusion from folks about why they can't get the stations that they used to get. We're hearing from folks who are saying they're still waiting for their coupons. And we're hearing other people really sort of thankful that they've got more time to get the coupons.
Well, and you also have a website, and we'll link to it at our website here and now.org. But you have a website with a page where people can select from long list of television makes and models, find out if they need to upgrade. They can apply for a converter box coupon. And also the FCC has a hotline where you can get information specific to your local area, and we'll have that at our website as well. But just why haven't more people gotten ready? We've had so much notice.
It's very difficult to say. Some people simply aren't ready because they waited until late December to order coupons, and they ended up on a waiting list. And if they were on that waiting list, they won't be getting coupons until, you know, at the earliest, the end of this month and maybe the beginning of next month. Americans also tend to procrastinate.
Really?
we know tax time is coming, but people wait until the last minute to get things done. You know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a lawyer. I wish I understood these things, but I really don't.
Right. Well, we just want to add that, of course, there is another option if all else fails, and that is radio.
That's right.
Mark Lloyd, Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights in Washington, D.C. Mark, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Rob.
By the way, we told you that we'd have the story of Folsom Prison Blues and whether or not Johnny Cash wrote that song. We will have that story for you tomorrow. Welcome back. The American auto industry is struggling, but we wanted to look back at a time when it was all-powerful, and yet not as powerful in the long run as one determined man, Robert Kearns. Flash of genius is the phrase the Supreme Court uses to define an idea that inspires an invention. It's also the title of a film that tells Robert Kearns' story. He was a college engineering professor living with his large and loving family in 1960s Detroit. In the blink of an eye, their lives changed. He invented something called the intermittent windshield wiper. It blinked or paused, giving the driver a second-long break from the wipers. We take it for granted today, but back then, Kearns, his wife, and their six kids pile into the family car to test it.
Hey, you see that car across the street?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Look at the driver staring at me. He thinks I'm turning the wiper on and off here. Look at this. No, no. Look here. Look at that, mister. No hands. He's wondering what the heck's going on.
Bob Kearns dreamed of having his invention, the Kearns Blinking Eye Motor, in every car in America. He and his friend Gil Previck, who works in the industry, take it to the Ford Motor Company. The engineers at Ford are astounded that Robert has solved a problem they've been working on for years. Later, though, Gil gives Bob the bad news.
They want out, Bob.
Who wants out?
Ford.
What?
They're just not interested anymore.
Bob is devastated, even more so when a few years later, Ford comes out with a new car with an intermittent windshield wiper. Bob Kearns' real-life David and Goliath battle to prove Ford stole his idea was the subject of a New Yorker article and then the film Flash of Genius, which is out on DVD this week. We spoke with director Mark Abraham and star Greg Kinnear when the film first opened and began by asking Greg, with all of the research he did on the character, what did he want to bring about Bob Kearns to the film?
I wanted to bring his very unique humanness. I mean, he was not an unflawed man. And unlike the David Goliath stories sometimes you see in the movies where the protagonist is painted in these great heroic colors, this guy was a real man. He was short-tempered and abrasive and prickly and untrusting. In spite of all of that, though, I saw this kind of underlying dignity in the guy, and I desperately wanted him to succeed.
Well, you know, you say prickly and untrusting and angry, but who wouldn't be, you know, after something like this? I mean, you wonder at some point, he loses his job in this fight. He briefly loses his mind. He loses his marriage. And I'm wondering, is he ill and irascible or, wouldn't anybody be that way?
Sure they would. And I think what we tried to do was magnify those kind of idiosyncrasies and those shortcomings of this guy and show that the case was having an effect on his life, because in talking to his children, all indications were that, you know, he was a different man, you know, 12 years later after this whole thing started than he was when it started.
Mark, this is your directing debut. You've been a producer. And we do understand that Kearns' family was hesitant to make it at first. So you have a little bit of pressure there to get it right?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't modulate how right or wrong it was based upon my commitment to the Kearns family. I would have done exactly the same thing no matter, you know, who they were. In this case, this is a tough family. They've been through a lot of litigation, so you knew that they would challenge you at every turn. And Bob challenged me in the early days on the telephone about why to, you know, how to make the movie.
Oh, so he was alive when you first spoke
with
him? Oh,
yeah, he was alive. Because I first optioned the material almost 9 years ago. So
what were those conversations like?
The conversations with him would be exactly what you would expect after having seen the film. He was nervous about how the story would be told. He wasn't certain that it would be told the way he wanted it. He at one point said to me, how do I know that you're just not going to option our story and take it and sit on it, never let it come to light a day? Or what about if you were going to take it and tell the story about the Ford Motor Company being the heroes?
He really thought that might be possible?
Yeah, he did. He thought somehow it might get his words might, as Rudyard Kipling said, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools or something, you know? But I explained to him that even in Hollywood, that wasn't a particularly good story. The idea of a corporation crushing a little guy,
right.
that didn't really get people that excited.
Well, you can understand as you watch his life story how he might fear that, because they were winning every step of the way. Now, Kearns ultimately goes to court, but before that, there are points when Ford offers to settle with him once through a lawyer that Kearns had hired. He's played by Alan Alda. Here, that lawyer is telling Kearns, take the money.
They'll bury you with motions, injunctions, countersuits. They'll drown you in so many irrelevant documents that you'll wake up with cold sweats. And 5 years from now, you won't be any closer to seeing the inside of a courtroom than you are right now.
Here's Robert Kern's response at that dinner.
I always thought I was put here on this earth for a purpose. I thought it was to be an engineer or maybe an inventor, but that's not it, and now I know what it is.
God put you here to sue the Ford Motor Company.
Look, I brought these here thinking that you had different ideas. Edwin Armstrong invented the FM radio. Somehow RCA ended up with a patent. He jumped out a 13-story window. This was a good man. He was an inventor. And look, I have letters from people. People who've had their ideas taken from them. They've heard about us. They're in their backyards and their garages, and they're counting on me.
Greg Kinnear, you know, he turns down money at that dinner. Later during the trial, he turns down a $30 million settlement offer from Ford. You look at that and you watch his, you know, kids dressed in bedraggled clothes, and you think, you're thinking maybe he should take it. But, you know, again, is that obstinance or is that heroic?
I don't know. I mean, we live in a culture of compromise. We live in a culture of settlements, and we have game shows about take the money. And people, I think it's funny from the audience perspective, they're unsettled. They almost have Ford's perspective by the end, you know, halfway through the movie, like, what's wrong with this guy? Right. Just bend a little bit and we'll all be okay here.
Mark, anything, you know, as you made this film, anything, I mean, you, as you well know, screenwriters get their ideas stolen all the time.
Absolutely.
This has made people crazy in Hollywood. Anything you'd fight that hard for, give up that much for?
It's hard to say. I think there probably would be something in terms of my family or something in a much more emotional way, but my point about making the movie is that most of us, and I believe this is fine, would reach a place where we couldn't go any farther. We would say, and that's the general nature of the human condition, is like you fight, and then at some point somebody rational explains to you why that fight's not going to become beneficial anymore, and you're going to, the cost is going to become greater than the result. And that's when the money comes in, and most of us would say, yeah, fine, okay, I don't want to take the money, and by taking the money, I know that you're saying I agree with you, I don't, but I'm sick of fighting and everybody.
And we should say, in his case, it wasn't the money he wanted. He wanted the recognition.
He wanted
it was
the
his
recognition.
Invention. Right.
Mm-hmm. Every now and then, a man or a woman comes along and takes on a battle, and they could be as big as civil rights. It could be about nonviolence. It could be about the largest idea, and they will fight. And those type of people sometimes will fight all the way to their own death. We would have stopped before that, but because they were willing to go that far, we're the beneficiaries of their battle. I think Bob was one of those guys. It takes a somewhat selfish person. It takes a person with incredible focus. It takes someone who's not going to be bought off to do that. That's what's interesting about Bob.
One last question for you, Greg. So how are you now with windshield wipers when you're driving?
Well, I can't use my intermittent windshield wiper without thinking of our little story. And I think that, the movie's not about intermittent windshield wipers, of course, but it's impossible not to recognize this tiny little device, and certainly how inspirational it was to this guy, and how, you know, it's the one thing you can tell about cars. Explain it to somebody, and they kind of go, oh, yeah.